About David, oh gosh, back in 1998-99 when I was doing an interim ministry in Albany, and we had a couple members of the Albany church who'd been in David's church in Summit and just raved about him as a great preacher and a great minister. He's one of the few, especially today when most people go into the ministry as a second or third or fourth or fifth career. David is one of the few who knew from an early age that this is what he wanted to do. And he never doubted it. He went to college. He served a church in Ohio, and then he went to seminary at Meadville and has never looked back, has never doubted what he was trying to do. We were talking yesterday about hobbies, and I use hobbies kind of as a way to leave work behind and get into some therapy where I can get my head somewhere else, so I'll do wood turning or something. And I said, what hobbies do you have? And he said, I don't really have any hobbies. And I said, how do you get away from the work? And he said, well, I've never wanted to. Now, that could be the description of a dismal man. But it's not. And so it's a treat, really, just to spend time with someone who has been content in a calling that he felt at a young age and has served it very, very well for a long time. He's been professor of ministry at Meadville since January of 1999. And he was saying it's the first time in his life that he had really a different job, that instead of being a minister and a preacher, he's now a teacher since then, and likes that too, and has a few more years of doing that. I think what David brings that I love is the kind of thing I was trying to talk about in the sermon a while ago. That spirit, that awareness of that kind of spirit that has to infect us and command us. So it's with great pride and great honor that I introduce to you Professor David Bumbaugh.
It's an enormous pleasure to be with you, and I thank you for the invitation to share this weekend with you. I've met a number of old friends, a few students who actually survived some of my classes, and I've met a number of new people, and I feel welcomed and I appreciate it. I do want to bring you greetings from Meadville Lombard Theological School. It's students, its faculty, its administration, its staff, and remind you that this is your theological school affiliated with the University of Chicago. What the world needs from liberal religion. Now that is a sweeping topic and one that is daunting to say the least. Who among us is qualified to speak for the world? For that matter, who among us is qualified to speak for liberal religion? Unitarians and Universalists have long been part of what is generally known as liberal religion, but the scope of liberal religion is far larger than our movement. Liberal religion is a context in which we exist, but it is neither defined by nor exhausted by our particular institutional histories, structures, or visions. Nonetheless, that's the topic we've been called to address, and my long career as a preacher has equipped me fully to speak with great authority on vast subjects about which I know precious little. Now, I promise you that I will not go back further than two centuries, and I fear that I probably shall be fairly parochial. I want to begin in May of 1961. I stood on the floor of the General Assembly, waiting for the moderator to announce the result of the vote that would bring the Unitarian Universalist Association into existence. a vote that would end the separate histories of the American Unitarian Association and the Universalist Church of America. And when the formal announcement came, no one was surprised. The Assembly had reaffirmed the will of its constituent congregations with an overwhelming vote for consolidation, and the delegates responded with a standing ovation. Now, this was a moment I had worked for since I began my ministry to Universalist churches in April of 1957. I had preached, written editorials, and debated about the promise inherent in the consolidation of the American Unitarian Association and the Universalist Church of America. I had attended the meeting in Syracuse that had hammered out the details of the consolidation process. The congregation I was serving at the time had voted strongly for consolidation, even though the members of that small rural church confessed to feeling profoundly outclassed by and inferior to every Unitarian they had ever met. Now, I should have been among those applauding the vote. Instead, I found myself standing off to one side of the hall, weeping. I was overwhelmed by the sense that something important had just died, that I had voted away my religious home, that I had just witnessed the end of the Universalist movement, a movement, in the words of historian Whitney Cross, whose impact on reform movements and upon the growth of modern religious attitudes might prove to be greater than that of either the Unitarians or the Freethinkers, a movement whose warfare on the forces fettering the American mind might be demonstrated to have equaled the influence of the Transcendentalist philosophers. Over the nearly half century that has passed, I have devoted my life to the movement we brought into being in Boston on that day in May of 1961. In parish ministry, and now teaching at one of our two remaining seminaries, my life has been trammeled up in Unitarian Universalism. But truth be told, I have never felt quite at home in this movement. I have felt rather like an orphan who's been taken in by a kindly family, but who has never mastered the skills necessary to be fully part of that family. Somewhere deep in my soul, there is a sense of loss that never quite goes away. And in odd moments, I've tried to plumb the depths of that loss. And over time, it's occurred to me that the loss, which often seemed so personal, is in truth much more corporate and institutional. Somewhere over the years following consolidation, we lost an important insight into the essential nature of religion and the role it plays in the life of the human community. The process by which that loss occurred is rooted deep in the history of the two movements that came together in May of 1961. In the first third of the 20th century, Unitarianism and Universalism both were confronting serious losses. The catastrophe of the Great War, that war to end all wars, had made a mockery of the easy optimism that had characterized so much of liberal religion. The debacle of the Great Depression had only deepened the sense of pessimism and despair. And by the middle of the 1930s, the condition of the Unitarian movement was so desperate that the American Unitarian Association was forced to appoint a commission of appraisal. The central charge to that commission consisted of a series of questions. Has Unitarianism any real function in the modern world? How far does Unitarianism in America measure up to the requirements of the New Age? What must be done to bring it reasonably close to that ideal? And is the expenditure of effort necessary to bring about that change justified by the promise of success? Well, the report of the commission addressed a number of topics, ranging from a sketchy effort to define areas of doctrinal agreement and disagreement to a concern for restructuring religious education and providing more adequate training for leaders. But the elements in the report that received most of the attention centered upon restructuring, reorganizing, and streamlining the institutional processes of the association itself. And the effect of the report was to give short shrift to questions of faith and to focus much more attention on questions of structure and process. Now, the commission is widely believed to have saved the American Unitarian Association and to have ushered in a period of renewal and growth. In my reading of the history, it did so simply by assuming Unitarianism has a function in the modern world, even if that function is almost impossible to define. By finessing any serious conversation about theological concerns, and by focusing instead on the question of how to reorganize the National Association so it might function more effectively. Out of the work of the Commission came a series of important initiatives, ranging from the New Beacon series in religious education to that famous advertising initiative from the Layman's League based on the question, "Are you a Unitarian without knowing it?" and ultimately the whole fellowship movement. During this same period, Universalism was experiencing an even more catastrophic decline. Once having been described as the reigning heresy of the day and credited with being the sixth largest denomination in the country, Universalism had declined to fewer than 50,000 adherents, was closing one rural or small town church after another all over the country, and was watching as one urban church after another either went out of business or merged with its Unitarian counterpart. But Universalism responded to that challenge in quite a different way. Universalists sought to confront the losses that threatened their continued existence by theological exploration. Under the leadership of men like Robert Cummins and Brainerd Gibbons, Universalists began to explore their relationship to the Christian tradition out of which they had come. They asked, what is the essential message of Universalism, given the fact that mainline Protestants no longer proclaim doctrines of hellfire and damnation? They asked, does Universalism have anything distinctive to offer to the larger theological conversation? They asked, what does universal salvation mean in a pluralistic world grown ever more integrated and ever more interconnected? Cummins, the general superintendent of the Universalist Church, began to address those questions when he told his General Assembly that, and I quote, Universalism cannot be limited either to Protestantism or to Christianity, not without denying its very name. Ours is a world fellowship, not just a Christian sect. A circumscribed universalism is unthinkable. Subsequently, Tracy Pullman of Detroit called for an understanding of universalism that would be greater than Christianity. Cummins' successor as general superintendent, Brainerd Gibbons, insisted that Christianity and the larger universalism are simply incompatible. Now, these observations led a group of younger ministers to engage the challenge to define a new theological base for the Universalist Church. They advocated what they called a new universalism, one that would define a religion adequate to a global community. They were not seeking to create a new world religion, but they dreamed of creating a religion that would be more adequate to one world. And this led them to engage virtually all the theological categories that had structured their tradition and seek to determine how to reform and reconstitute that tradition for a new time and a new context. And that process continued throughout all the years leading up to consolidation. Now, the point to this long excursion into history is to suggest that Unitarians and Universalists brought quite different agendas to that consolidation. And those differences were reflected in much of the debate surrounding the proposals to consolidate. As I remember those years, I'm struck by the fact that much of the Universalist opposition to consolidation was theological in nature. Traditionalists like Ellsworth Riemann, fearing that the new movement would strengthen the hands of those who sought to move Universalism to an enlarged and non-Christian theological base. On the other hand, much of Unitarian opposition was institutionally focused, a fear, as A. Powell Davies suggested, that consolidation with Universalists would slow or halt the numerical growth that had allowed Unitarians to claim to be the fastest-growing denomination in America in the 1950s. I've sometimes summarized these two agendas by suggesting that Universalists brought to merger an important but unfinished theological concern, while Unitarians brought to merger a set of highly questionable marketing plans. I would suggest to you that in the years after consolidation, concern for marketing has triumphed. The overriding concerns have centered upon the need to identify our market niche, to devise programs and strategies that will attract and keep clients. Increasingly, much of our social justice effort can be defined as expressionist politics, less interested and intended in changing the world than to serve our own egos, to present a profile to the world, and attract and expand our client base. Our efforts at self-definition, the all but deified purposes and principles, are grounded in no deep confession of faith or any meta-narrative. They simply hang there as unanchored assertion. Not a covenant, but a temporal agreement. And because that is so, they betray the fact that a primary motivating force in their construction was to offend none of our stakeholders, while being so general that likely recruits will not find us too challenging. Our programmatic focus has been upon growth, both in size and in number of churches. Programs are initiated and justified on the basis that they will produce numerical growth. Congregations and individuals who question whether growth is an adequate mission are regarded as bordering on the heretical. Education programs among us are designed specifically to counter and inhibit the essential developmental tasks of young people and to bind them effectively to the church. We have toyed with creating megachurches by offering something called Theology Light Seeker Services. We've devised advertising programs structured around slogans like the uncommon denomination and the church that puts its faith in you. Slogans that pretend to communicate but that avoid any careful definition. Most recently, I would suggest, the triumph of marketing can be seen in the process by which the flaming chalice has been transformed from religious symbol to marketing logo. Missing in all of this is any coherent theological foundation. Over and over, we hear each other and officials of this association proclaim the conviction that we have a moral obligation to grow, to spread our word, because we possess a vital message, one that is of central importance to the world and to the crises in which the world is entangled. When, however, we are challenged to say precisely what that message is, what our faith consists of, what defines us as a religious people, we are usually driven to an embarrassed silence, or we smile and confess smugly that no one can speak for all Unitarian Universalists, or we stutter and stammer some half-digested truisms about the worth of every person or the importance of embracing each person's freedom to follow his or her own spiritual path. Now, those aren't wrong affirmations, but they provide an incredibly weak foundation for a religious movement and a wholly inadequate program for saving the world. They offer an unexamined piety rather than a solid faith. The unfinished task Universalists brought to consolidation, the effort to redefine the faith tradition in light of contemporary challenges, has been swept away by the fear that if we define ourselves too clearly, someone may be offended. Now, we're not the only example of liberal religion trying to survive by fudging uncomfortable self-definition. In Chicago, and perhaps elsewhere across the country, the United Methodist Church observed Lent this year by broadcasting a series of television spots in which people who are lonely, people who are burdened with grief, people who are engulfed by sorrow, are told that they do not have to walk this painful path alone. They will find support and companionship at the United Methodist Church. Except for that last word, church, it's hard to tell the welcome is from a religious community. It sounds very much like an institution offering therapy rather than faith, comfort rather than challenge, and security rather than adventure. In his book, American Religious Traditions, Richard Wentz suggests that religion is, quote, the dialectic of the sacred and the profane, the way in which the sacred and the mundane are held together in dynamic tension. He claims that religion provides the ideas and actions that enable us to maintain the significance of the sacred in circumstances that deny it. This suggests that a movement that is unwilling or unable to define what it holds sacred has surrendered both its claim to religious significance and its ability to respond meaningfully to the larger world. If we are to respond to the needs of our world from a liberal religious basis, it is critical we be able to address and answer three central questions. What do we believe? Whom do we serve, and to whom or to what are we responsible? Several years ago, I was asked to deliver a lecture on the title Beyond the Seven Principles, the Core of Our Faith, and in that lecture I suggested that the question of what do we believe probably can't be answered till we've struggled with the question whom do we serve. I'm increasingly convinced now, however, that given the makeup of our movement and of our times, it is important that the question of what it is we believe, what it is that provides a foundation for a vital religious vision, be given priority over the other two. The first and foundational question, what do we believe, is simple, but profoundly challenging for a postmodern people because it drives us to consider what are the appropriate boundaries to our religious community? What is so central to our identity, we must proclaim it even at the risk of offending someone? That's the question Universalists were struggling to answer in the years prior to consolidation, the question I think we've tried very hard to evade in the interest of more effective marketing ever since. It is in answering the first question we may discover effective responses to the other two. Whom do we serve? To whom and to what are we responsible? Ignoring that first question, our institutions are easily seduced by the consumerist imperatives that dominate our time, and our response to the world tends to be shallow-rooted, short-lived, self-serving, and episodic. Now, strange as it may seem to us, the fear of defining ourselves has not always dominated Unitarianism or Universalism. The founding document of American Unitarianism was Channing's 1819 Baltimore sermon, Unitarian Christianity, in which he laid out a clear platform that not only rallied Unitarians, but influenced large numbers of non-Unitarians as well. Later in the same century, when Unitarianism was grappling with the dissent generated by the radical thought of Theodore Parker and his followers, William Channing Gannett offered a statement of things commonly believed among us, and he boldly included in his statement the affirmation, "We believe." In 1935, the Universalists struggling to define their movement adopted a statement that, while never a creed, unashamedly began with these words, "We avow our faith." Let me suggest to you that what the world needs from liberal religion, at least as a start, is clarity about who we are and what matters to us. clarity about what vision has called us into being and what hope we serve. Nor is this such an impossible challenge. While we proudly proclaim the great diversity among us, every study I have seen of Unitarian Universalists suggests that our diversity rests in a powerfully homogeneous core of shared beliefs and attitudes. Indeed, the studies suggest that at core, we are far less diverse than many other religious groups. Let me suggest to you some of the content of that core. We believe that the universe in which we live and move and have our being is the expression of an inexorable process that began eons ago in ages beyond our comprehension and has evolved from singularity to multiplicity, from simplicity to complexity, from disorder to order. We believe that the earth and all who live upon the earth are the products of the same process that swirled the galaxies into being, that ignited the stars and orbited the planets through the night sky, that we are expressions of a universal process which has created and formed us out of recycled stardust. We believe that all living things are members of a single community, all expressions of a planetary process that produced life and sustains it in intricate ways beyond our knowing. Therefore, we hold the life process itself to be sacred. We believe that the health of the human venture is inextricably dependent upon the integrity of the rest of the community of living things and upon the integrity of the processes by which life is bodied forth and sustained. Therefore, we affirm that we are called to serve the planetary process upon which we all depend. We believe that in this interconnected existence, the well-being of one cannot be separated from the well-being of the whole, that ultimately we all spring from the same source and we all journey to the same ultimate destiny. We believe that the universe outside of us and the universe within us is one universe. And because that is so, our efforts, our dreams, our hopes, our ambitions are the ambitions and hopes and dreams of the universe itself. In us, and perhaps elsewhere, the universe is reaching toward self-awareness, toward self-consciousness. We believe that our efforts to understand the world and our place within it are an expression of the universe's deep drive toward meaning. In us, and perhaps elsewhere, the universe dreams dreams and reaches toward unknown possibilities. We hold as sacred the unquenchable drive to know and to understand. We believe that the moral impulse that weaves its way through our lives, luring us to practices of justice and mercy and compassion, is threaded throughout the universe itself, and it is this universal longing that finds outlet in our best moments. We believe that our location within the community of living things places upon us inescapable responsibilities. Life is more than our understanding of it, but the level of our comprehension demands that we act out of a conscious concern for the broadest vision of community we can command, and that we seek not our welfare alone, but the welfare of the whole. We are commanded to serve life, and to serve it to the 7x70th generation. We believe that those least like us, those located on the margins, have important contributions to make to the rest of the community of life, and that in some curious way, we are every one of us located on the margins. We believe that all that functions to divide us from each other and from the community of living things is to be resisted in the name of that larger vision of a world everywhere alive, everywhere seeking to incarnate a deep, implicate process that called us into being, that sustains us in being, that transforms us as we cannot transform ourselves, that receives us back to itself when life has used us up. Not knowing the end of that process, nonetheless, we trust it, we rest in it, and we serve it. Now, this faith statement is not a creed. Perhaps we ought to attach to it the historic Universalist Freedom Clause. You remember those words. Neither this nor any other form of words will ever be used among us as a creedal test. Nor can it be easily reduced to an elevator speech. But it attempts to achieve several things. First of all, it seeks to avoid the morass of hyphenated Unitarian Universalism. Secondly, it seeks to avoid the dreary debate between humanists and theists, between spirituality and rationality, by offering a kind of godless theism, an affirmation that we are not sui generis, that we are products of a natural process we did not create, cannot command, do not fully understand, but a process to which we are responsible. A process grounded in a vision of a dynamic universe, constantly incarnating emergent possibilities and larger alternatives. It offers a vision that is consistent with our history, our tradition, responsive to the people we serve, and to the challenges of our time. A vision grounded in four central Enlightenment commitments defined by Susan Nyman as joy, reason, reverence, and hope. And most importantly, it seeks to define a religious position that provides us a distinct location within the spectrum of religious alternatives available to the world. Now, probably this statement will not prove adequate or acceptable to most of us, but the times demand some kind of formulation of the basis of our faith if we're to be serious about the world and if we're to be taken seriously by the world. Out of this kind of faith statement, imperatives for action emerge that are deeper than a political program or a class or ethnic loyalty. Such a faith statement reminds us that we are called to serve the largest vision of community we can imagine, and that all our lesser loyalties stand under the judgment of that great affirmation. In serving the party, the cause, the national or the ethnic identity, am I serving the largest community I can envision? In failing the weak, the lost, the marginalized, have I failed my deepest defining obligations? Such a faith statement allows us to recognize that ultimately we are responsible to the larger sacred context out of which we have come and in terms of which we live. It provides a compass by which to steer amidst the uncertainties of a chaotic world. As I've confessed, this statement may not capture adequately the imagination of Unitarian Universalists, but I am quite certain that some statement of faith is required if our brand of liberal religion is to address the needs of our world. Now, why we prefer to focus on our minor disagreements rather than on a core of faith that might define us and offer us a religious alternative, I'm not fully certain. Maybe it's something deep in our institutional DNA at work here. In his 2-volume History of Unitarianism, Earl Morse Wilbur argued that for most of our history, Unitarians have resisted any real theological definition. Only when faced with some great threat to the continued existence of the movement could Unitarians be brought to define who they were and what vision they served. Well, I would suggest to you that we face such a threat at this moment in our history. To be sure, the threat does not seem to take the form of repression, persecution, or proscription. Despite the occasional jabs from religious extremists, we are scarcely important enough to justify the effort that repression and persecution would require. The threat to our existence is more subtle and therefore more dangerous. Liberal religion faces the possibility that it may be overwhelmed by a kind of ambient spirituality that resists definition or institutional form, but functions to use the human longing for meaning to serve other purposes. An ambient spirituality that has no outward focus, but that slides easily into the therapeutic mode, offering an endless journey of infinite regression into the self. Look around you, and you will see everywhere evidence of the manner in which spiritual longing has been commodified, offered on the open market, used to sell everything from soap to self-improvement to political platforms. Over and over and over again, the sacred is stripped of its deepest meanings and chained naked to the chariot wheels of a triumphant consumerism. By refusing to define itself, liberal religion surrenders its ability to stand in judgment on the idolatries of our time. Worse than that, fearing it will not be taken seriously, liberal religion is tempted to try to turn the commercial spirit of the age to its own uses. Os Guinness once remarked that it used to be the case that religion looked for an audience for its message. But more recently, he says, religion looks for a message that will hold the audience. Though there's a world of difference between those two approaches. To the degree that liberal religion in general and Unitarian Universalism in particular have succumbed to this kind of marketing ploy, they have betrayed their own traditions, they have failed the world, they have become captive to the very processes that threaten to destroy our best hope for the future. If we are to serve our people and the world in which we find ourselves, it's critical that we now take up again the unfinished project that Universalism brought to the consolidation in 1961. That we have the courage to define ourselves in ways that offer a clear alternative, both to the dangerous and divisive orthodoxies that seem to have captured the religious venture, and to the refusal to embrace a clear identity that threatens to sweep liberal religion into commodified, thumb-sucking irrelevance. It's time for liberal religion to declare clearly the faith we hold. The world has a right to expect at least that much from us. Thank you.